Okay, I think we're ready to get started. In April of 1912, exactly 100 years ago this month, an experiment was conducted in Göttingen, Germany that revolutionized science. In my opinion, actually, it's one of the most important scientific experiments ever done. My name is Greg Girolami. I'm a professor of chemistry and one of the co-curators of the exhibit. And I just want to tell you just very brief things about the exhibit, and then I'll introduce our speaker for today. I was lucky to have a couple of really great co-curators for this. Vera Mainz, my wife, helped me with this, also a chemist. And Dennis Sears, here from the Rare Book Library. Also, we had some help from Valerie Hotchkiss, the head librarian of the Rare Book and Special Collections, and also help with the posters from Chloe Bottenhoff, and some support from the Department of Chemistry, and also from the Veldy Fund here in the university. Sorry?
Doug.
Yes, I was not going to mention, okay. Not going to forget Doug. So, in addition to the rare books, which come from the collection of the University of Illinois, which you see around here, there are 30 of them that we picked to illustrate the history of the development of crystallography, both in its classical sense, in terms of identifying different crystals and crystal forms, to its modern incarnation as a way of understanding the molecular structure of matter. And that's so it's the experiment that was done in 1912 was to direct a beam of X-rays at a crystal or a couple of different crystals and found that a special effect called diffraction took place where the beam was broken up into several different beams. And in work done later, as we'll hear from our speaker, it proved possible to interpret that diffraction pattern to understand the structure of samples from as simple as table salt. And it's hard to imagine today. There was a time only 100 years ago where we did not know what the structure of table salt was, but also allowed us to understand the structures of much more complicated materials such as quartz all the way up to DNA and even living organisms such as viruses. We're also lucky in that to sort of set off the displays of the books. We have a series of very nice mineral specimens which were contributed or lent to us by Professor Doug McDonald of the Chemistry Department. And for the most part, they actually are tied to the books that are in the cases that they are in. For example, in the ancient Greek case is a sample of stibnite, which is used by Cleopatra as an eyeliner back in those days. So let me introduce our speaker for today. Our speaker is Cy Mauskopf, who is the professor emeritus and director of the Focus.
No, I'm not director anymore. Because I'm professor emeritus.
At Duke University.
Okay. Was professor emeritus.
He was the first Edelstein International Fellow in the history of chemical sciences and technology, and also the Price Fellow at the Chemical Heritage Foundation in Philadelphia in the year 2000. In 1998, he received the Dexter Award for outstanding contributions to the history of chemistry from the American Chemical Society, which is their top award. His research interests in the history of science have been varied over the years and include the history of chemistry and allied sciences in the 18th and 19th centuries, the history of chemical technology, focusing on munitions and explosives, and the history of parapsychology and marginal science. But he'll tell you, actually, that he started off early in his career with an interest in crystallography, which is one of the reasons that he is here today. He's also edited two books reflective of these different interests, including The Reception of Unconventional Science, which was published in 1979, and Chemical Sciences in the Modern World, which appeared in 1993. So it's my pleasure to introduce Professor Cy Mauskopf.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much. Let me give an applause for another book that just came out, co-edited with Springer, called Integrating the History and Philosophy of Science. So look for it on your website. Buy it. Just got the first royalty check. I need more. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Vera for inviting me to keep you. I might say I hate PowerPoint lectures where you can't read the text. Mm-hmm. Don't you?
Yes.
And I hope back there, therefore, I'm feeling very guilty. I hope you'll all be able to read the text. I'll be reading it out for you in part. It's a long and rich talk, I dare say. Come on might be about two-thirds of the way through it. I will sing you a song, or at least part of a song, and maybe ask you to all join in and sing along with me. So I hope that you haven't been to many lectures in the history of crystallography where the lecturer sings a song. So
I'm looking forward to
that. To look forward to. Well, let me get started, if I can. Okay. As Greg said, This is the, in fact, it was in Munich, I believe, rather than Göttingen. They were in Munich.
You might be right.
I think I am right. I've been researching this. In fact, and it was April 23rd, 1912, so we are a week beyond the actual centenary. So that's quite good aim, actually. It really is very good. And this is this plus the collection here is, I guess, why I'm here talking. Whoops, going the wrong way. And now, I checked the Latin with my medieval historian daughter at IU University. My apologia pro oratione mea, apology for my lecture. And here it is, Greg's given. I am not a crystallographer. Many, many years ago, in the same graduate program that Evan Malhaldo was in a few years after me, our mentor, Charles Gillespie, put me on to the study of 18th century crystallography, particularly the crystallographical theories of René Justeri. This became my dissertation, taking it up through Louis Pasteur's first major discovery, which we'll be talking about more later. It was published in 1976 as Crystals and Compounds, 36 years ago, half a lifetime. And since then, as Greg mentioned, I've been working in the history of parapsychology, more recently the history of explosives, munitions, and I'm trying to finish a long overdue book on Alfred Nobel. Cheer me on, because I want to get back to that when I go back home. You may want to invite me back to talk about that. Anyway, what the theme of my talk will be will come from my original research in this area and from Crystals and Compounds, namely the interplay of crystallography and chemistry in the elucidation of the invisible spatial arrangements of atoms and molecules. I agree with Greg that 1912 was a critical moment of advance in all of this, but the search for doing this goes back a long time, and I'm going to be talking about that search in my talk. Okay, now, this is the part for those in the back that you will hate. try to read that, I defy you. I'm going to read it for you. My talk, it's the organization of my talk, and it's going to be in three sections, three major moments. The first is there'll be a prehistory with the intriguing title of Seeds, Corpuscles, and Salts, followed by the first moment, namely the emergence in the 1780s of the first mathematical molecular crystal structure theory of someone who is not exactly a household name even among historians of science, probably is to crystallographers, René Justeri. The second moment will be the interplay of the chemical atomic theory with Auey's crystal structure theory in the early 19th century, especially in France, climaxing in Louis Pasteur's discovery in the spring also of 1848 of the asymmetrical forms of sodium ammonia tartrate crystals and their correlation with optical activity. More on what those things mean later. Another interlude where chemistry and crystallography go in their separate directions. Chemistry in eventually the development of structural stereochemistry. Crystallography becomes much more abstract and mathematical in the later 19th century, but coming back together in 1912 and the following years, with the discovery or invention, whichever you want to call it, of X-ray diffraction photography, and the follow-through with the works of William Henry and William Lawrence Bragg in England for the really the elucidation of atomic molecular structure in crystals. Okay? Mm-hmm. Follow me? With me?
Got it.
Okay. Now, can I, whoops. There we go. Okay. What I'm calling a Greek word this time, this is all prevarication to avoid getting into the talk. A little sociological excursus that occurred to me in reading the very recent issue of the Acta Crystallographica, which is devoted to the Lowy centenary. The initial introductory article intrigued me for its uses in different ways of crystallography, often within the same paragraph. So in one paragraph it says, although crystallography is today recognized as a mature science, I won't read the rest of it, just hold on to that. Then later on it says, crystallography is the interdisciplinary science. And then in the same paragraph, despite the fact that most scientists using crystallographical techniques would not call themselves crystallographers, etc., it's really the sociologist in me got intrigued by all of that. Whoops. Here we are. Is it a mature science? That is it an independent scientific discipline that's clearly delineated? Is it an interdisciplinary science that perhaps spans a number of different fields? Or is it a set of techniques by scientists who would be horrified to have find they were called crystallographers? I don't know the answer to this. But what it brought me back to my, and I'll mention the word, my wife said I shouldn't, she said people will leave, the fact that I worked on a history of parapsychology, that's ESP, telepathy and things like that. And what intrigued me at the time, that is in the 1930s through 1950, was the role of statistics and statisticians, which struck me when I read these phrases, remarkably similar. Is it an independent discipline within mathematics? Is it an interdisciplinary discipline? Or is it a set of techniques used and abused by people who would be horrified to be called statisticians? I think crystallography in some ways is similar to this. So you never can tell when following your research in crystallography by a history of parapsychology might lead to an insight. This may be a case. Okay? Now, again. Yes, okay. Seeds, corpuscles, and salts. I'm going to begin by, I'm going to go quite fast, so I hope you can follow me. An article by the distinguished historian of mineralogy, David Oldroyd, came out some time ago about mineralogy in the 16th and 17th century. And I'm going to begin with the photograph of this picture, I love it, of that very strange early 16th century figure, Paracelsus, somebody who is half scientist, half modalist, half God knows what else, ranter. And this is Oldroyd characterizing Paracelsus on living organisms in the ground. And what it's suggesting, to see where we're going, is to a vitalistic or organic view of growth of everything. Okay? Clearly, plants develop from seeds within the element earth into the element air, where fruits are born. Earth then serves as a matrix for the seeds of the plant, providing it with appropriate nourishment. The branches of the plant extend upward into the neighboring element air. Now, where does he go? Similarly, thinks Paracelsus, the matrix element water nourishes the seeds of minerals and metals, which grow into mature specimens within the earth. The matrix of minerals, the element water, forms a tree within the body of the earth, which deposits its fruit in due season, later to be harvested by man. This tree here is fascinating. Some of you may know the chemist and historian of chemistry at Johns Hopkins, Larry Principe. He actually made this for a conference that I attended. He made it's a kind of dendritic form. But this is undoubtedly what Paracelsus had in mind. Okay? That's the 16th century. In the 16th century, for those who don't know, witnessed the beginning of what some of us still call the scientific revolution, which came into its maturity in the 17th century, climaxing, if you will, in the work of Isaac Newton and others in the later 17th century. One of the features of its coming into a kind of maturity was the ascendancy of the mechanical philosophy and materialism, the idea that really all there was in the world, to take a leaf from René Descartes, aside from our thinking soul, was matter in motion. Everything was mechanical. And this worked its way into a transference of views of the origins and growths of minerals, crystals, and metals. In Nicolastino, for example, this again is still from David Oldroyd, in 1669. The accretion of crystalline matter provides the basis of the proposed explanation of crystal formation, and an organic origin of mineral crystals is explicitly denied. Okay, and next, if I can figure out now which way to go, there we go. From, you can see it up close if you want, right here, Robert Hooke's famous book, Micrographia, published in 1665. And here is Hooke espousing a corpuscular mechanical view. I could make probable that all these regular figures, look at the spelling, it's wonderful, that are so conspicuously various and curious, arise only from three or four simple positions of globular particles, and those the most plain, obvious, and necessary conjunctions of such figured particles that are possible. So I say, you can see the text and the pictures right here afterwards. And a bit later in the century, Christian Huygens, the Dutch physicist, publishes his Traité de la Lumière, Treatise on Light, in which he talks about the recently discovered phenomenon of double refraction, which you can see right there. In certain types of crystals, calcite, island spar crystals, calcium carbonate crystals, the ray of light is not just refracted once, but twice. And in this example, can you all see this down here? That's looking down through a calcite crystal on the word calcite written on that gray thing at the bottom.
An experiment done right here in this exhibition.
Ta-da!
Yeah.
Okay, so you can see it. And here is, what's wrong? This way. Here is Huygens, first of all, his general explanation for regular crystals. Like Hooke, he sees them as composed of globular corpuscles. In the case of double refracting crystals, he suggests maybe they have, these corpuscles have a different shape. Maybe they're flattened spheroids. And quite frankly, I didn't have time to go back and work out what he then does with this. But it's suggesting that perhaps you can explain anomalous phenomena in crystals still with a corpuscular model of spheres or spheroids. So we're moving far away from the organic view of Paracelsus that crystals grow like plants do from seeds in the ground. Okay? But none of this has very much to do with chemistry, and I thought I said I would tell you about the interplay of chemistry and crystallography. The 18th century offers the connection through the study of salts. It's only recently that we've begun to pay attention to, in depth, to the study of salts. That is, in the past 30, 35 years, it's recently. The chemical revolution used to be focused solely on gases, pneumatic chemistry, and something called phlogiston. The late Frederick L. Holmes really opened up the study of salts. Rather than just one salt, many salts in the 18th century, the results of combinations of the growing number of acids and bases that were identified in the 18th century. And this stimulated a number of people to look at salts which, coming from the Paracelsian and even Aristotelian tradition, were viewed as somehow as a form giver. Well, these different salts seem to have different crystalline shapes. And might it not be possible to correlate and even to do taxonomy on minerals and crystals through salts and saline crystalline shapes? And here, this is Linnaeus. Notice he's still harking back to the vitalist, the organic view. Minerals were somehow, or earths were impregnated by the form-giving salts to produce crystalline stones of specific shapes for specific salts. And he had four in mind, I can tell you afterwards, nitre, muria, natrum, and alum were the four he identified, and used this as a kind of taxonomy for minerals, just as he was using shapes and the likes as a taxonomy for the organic world. Okay, that's the prehistory. Now to the history. Molecular crystal structure theory. the bringing together of chemical composition and salts and crystalline forms suggested, particularly to French chemists in the mid-18th century, that maybe the invisible corpuscles that made up crystals and indeed everything else weren't globular, but maybe they were polyhedral, like cubes, like octahedrons, etc., octahedra. Maybe that was the shape. This was first clearly articulated by the mid-18th century chemist Rouelle, who, among other things, was Lavoisier's teacher, I might say, who in 1745 published an article on sel marine, or common salt, we were talking to begin with there. And Rouelle suggested from his microscopic and macroscopic observation of crystal growth of common salt, maybe they seemed to crystallize in cubic forms. Maybe they were composed of cubic molecules. And this view was further developed, by, in one of the most popular chemical books of the 18th century, the Dictionnaire de Chimie of Pierre-Joseph Macquer, published in 1766. And let me just read quickly. Although we do not know the figure of the primitive integrate molecules, by that it means the compound molecules of any body, we cannot but doubt that this primitive integrate, I'm losing, it's a mouthful, pardon me, integrate molecule of every different body have a constant, uniform, and peculiar shape. And if they had time and liberty to unite with each other by the sides most disposed to this union, they will form masses of a figure constantly uniform and similar. So he's suggesting constancy in the macroscopic crystalline form is derived from constancy of the microscopic molecular form, polyhedron. Follow me? With me?
Yep.
Okay, good. This was first developed, and I'm going to go quickly here. He's an interesting figure, but I didn't quite know what to do with him. Jean-Baptiste Rene de Lisle, a rather picaresque figure. He'd been in the French military and got interested in natural history. He basically served, as many people did, in the mania for collections of natural, historical, and curiosities general, mineral samples, coins, plants, and whatnot. He essentially served as the collector for wealthy aristocratic collectors, and that's how he made his money. He also got interested in crystallography along the way and published an essay de crystallographie in 1772, which was expanded into a much bigger work called just Crystallographie 11 years later in 1783. Here's a quotation from it, and notice how he's explicitly denying the organic, vitalistic, Paracelsian view here. Germs being inadmissible for, or seeds you can substitute, for explaining the formation of crystals, it is necessary to suppose that the integrate molecules have of bodies have each according to its own nature a constant and determinate figure. So he's really moving now, he's doing this the wrong way. He never really developed a fully articulated crystal structure theory from this, but he did enunciate a couple of things that became important. First of all, crystals of the same chemical nature at the macroscopic level derive from what he called a common primitive form. We'll see this in a minute being articulated by his rival and successor, Ali. Second of all, using the newly invented, in fact it was a friend of his who invented it, contact goniometer. Do you have any instruments displayed here?
Not here.
Goniometers, you should, yes. There, you'll see a picture for me in a minute. He came upon something that had been kind of enunciated a century before by Steno, but was really enunciated by Rome de Lisle, the law of constant interfacial angle. Namely, crystals of the same chemical nature had constant interangles between their faces. And here, in the here is a 18th century contact goniometer. You put the crystal really between the two kind of scissor edges there. Here is a later improvement, the reflecting goniometer by William Hyde Wollaston of the early 19th century, which measured the angles formed by the meeting of rays of light from the faces. This enabled crystallographers to measure the angles of much smaller crystals with accuracy. what I'm calling an instrumental technological moment, because it's very important. The historians of science, paying attention just to the development of scientific ideas, there's a tendency to ignore literally the instruments that make these ideas possible. And here's what, we'll see others later on. Okay, any questions with me?
Yes, sir.
I'm gonna try to speed up. Okay, here we get to the first fully articulated crystal structure theory. That household name, I hope he will be a household name to all of you soon, René Giustali. Hope he'll have a parade in town on his birthday, all sorts of things. Interesting figure. He's one of the few major scientists to be a Catholic priest. The only other major one I could think of was, I'm not sure he was a priest, he was a monk certainly, is Gregor Mendel. And think of the parallels. There are other...
Cabé Nollet,
yeah, good point, yeah, okay. Good point. Cabé Nollet, who did electrical experiments, literally charged the whole French royal palace guard.
Okay, well, then John Lessing was a minister.
What?
John Lessing was a minister.
Oh, okay. Yeah, not a Catholic priest. But I'm going to leave out Nollet. I'm going to ignore that. And just note, interesting, because in a sense, Alwi and Mendel both were dealing with structures. The one in the inorganic realm, the other, the, you might say, a metaphorical, at least, genetic structure in the organic realm. And they did come together, as I'm sure all you know, in the early 1950s by something else that I think is somewhere elucidated here, through X-ray diffraction photography, once again, the elucidation of the double helix. So you might give a kudo for the Catholic education or something, for producing these two important moments. Alwi received very good scientific education in both the natural history and in mathematics. In the year after his rival, Rome de Lille, published a crystallography, in 1784, Alwi published, and I won't try to say it in French, I always trip over, an essay on the theory of crystal structure, based again on this notion of the integrant molecule, the compound molecule, as a polyhedral form. Alwi's theory has a two-stage, both his matter theory and his crystal structure theory, two-stage, it's easy to envision. First of all, at the molecular level, the compound integrant molecules determinably shaped polyhedra for each chemical substance were composed of determinably shaped elementary molecules or constituent molecules. We couldn't get, Alwi was unable to say anything about what their shapes might be. It didn't really try. But assume that they were constant and therefore that the integrant molecule was made of a constant chemical composition and a fixed crystalline, fixed molecular form. Got that? Mm-hmm. Now, these integrant molecules in turn form the crystal, which also had two stages. A common primitive form, he got that probably from Rome de Lille, but articulated more, and on each face of the primitive form, secondary forms were generated by, like pyramids, by recessions of layers of molecules. If you wonder what this looks like, I happen to have a picture. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Okay? Here is the primitive form of the crystal is a cube. In both of these, the form of the integrant molecule is cubic as well. In this case, on each face, there's a recession of one layer of molecules per layer, one layer in for layer of molecule up. On this face is something more complicated. You go in one layer, but you go up two. And you produce different secondary forms, as are found in nature. And the model was allowed... I can't go into detail, it was a remarkably comprehensive model. It was also a quantitative model, because it generated angles of interfacial angles and different shapes. It generated real predictions. So I think you can see it's a quite important moment in the development of crystallography. Alley, as I suggested, believed that these integrant molecules were of constant chemical composition, and therefore, he, when he got interested in mineralogy, he defined the mineral species as for all minerals as being constant and fixed, and as embodied in this integrant molecule of fixed form and constant chemical composition. This was a remarkable analog to what was developing in chemistry in the first decade of the 19th century, namely the law of definite proportions, which I've studied in some detail in decades past. Next, the interplay of chemistry and basically some optics, but chemistry and crystallography leading to Louis Pasteur's discovery. Okay, here we hit a figure who is something of a household name to most people, John Dalton, who in 1808 published his new system of chemical philosophy, in which at the very end, as almost a kind of an afterthought, he lays out what's called the chemical atomic theory. And here you have a wonderful, these are illustrations from the new system, of what he meant. Chemical compounds were composed of small numbers of atoms. This allowed Dalton to dope out two laws of chemistry, which really, you might say, conceptually structured the immense amount of data that was coming up. One was the law of definite proportions. It follows automatically. A chemical molecule is made up of a specific small number of atoms. The other was the law of multiple proportions, equally important. When two elements combined to form more than one compound, there was a simple weight relationship. If you hold the weight of one of the elements constant, then the other element will combine in simple integer relationships in the two or however many compounds. This turned out to be immensely fruitful, especially when applied to organic chemistry by the 1830s, and has patterned chemistry, in a sense, ever since. Okay? Now, Dalton was not, despite these pictures here, was not particularly interested in the spatial arrangement of atoms, certainly not in crystals. He gave some attention to it, but very little. He was interested in weight relationships, and that was the strength of the chemical atomic theory. By the same token, Alley, although he knew of Dalton's atomic theory, doesn't seem to have paid very much attention to it. However, there were others in France who combined the two quite creatively to produce, you might say, models of a kind of structural chemistry of atoms arranged in space. The first of them, let's see how I'm going, I think I'm going pretty well, is a rather unexpected figure, André-Marie Ampère. What's Ampère best known for? His work in what? Ampère as in? Electricity, yeah. He's known primarily as the one of the great, with Michael Faraday, his sometimes rival, as one of the great architects of modern electrical theory. Before he got into this, though, he was really interested in also chemical matters. In a paper in 1814, he actually restated the law that had been published 3 years earlier by the Italian Amedeo Avogadro. Avogadro's law, which states equal volumes of gases contain equal numbers of molecules. Now, that may seem unproblematic, except when you think about elementary gases. The only way one could make sense of that law for elementary gases was to assume that they must be polyatomic. That is, they must have nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen. The molecules must have more than one atom. Ampère asserted the same law. He justified it, interestingly enough, by appealing metaphorically to crystal structure theory and to this notion of polyhedral molecules. As this is a picture taken from his article, that molecules, all molecules, were polyhedral, and chemical combination was a kind of interposition of these molecules to form compounds. For the gaseous molecules, he used four of Alley's so-called primitive forms. His theory, in fact inspired, and this is one of the meat of crystals and compounds, a tradition in France of thinking in terms of what I'll call structural, chemical, and crystallographical speculations. The two major figures are, again, probably not household names to any of you, a crystallographer, mineralogist named Gabriel Delafosse, and a chemist named Auguste Laurent. Both, in fact, influenced profoundly the work, the early work of Louis Pasteur in his grave. That's what I'm getting up to. I'll try to get through this as quickly as I can. Delafosse had been Alison's student and became a professor at the École Normale. He was Pasteur's lecturer on mineralogy, and Evan and I were just talking about the fact that we've been throwing out our own life's work as I had to downsize my office. One thing Pasteur did was keep everything, and Pasteur became sufficiently important, unlike me at least, that other people saved it. So at the École Normale, you can find all of Pasteur's student notebooks at the Bibliothèque Nationale, all of his student notebooks from the École Normale, including Delafosse's. Now, what Delafosse was trying to do, going beyond his teacher, Auy, was actually to see if he could get a handle on the actual physical chemical molecule that composed crystals, not just sort of hypothetical polyhedra. And he focused on what he called, what are called hemihedral characteristics of certain types of crystals. Hemihedral crystals, as I say at the bottom here, possess incomplete symmetry. The requirement that any modification of an angular image be reproduced on all other symmetrically placed angles was not fulfilled. And he used these, and this is 1843, to try to, this is again from a publication of his, try to get to, maybe you could, by this, get some kind of handle on what the actual arrangement of the atoms in the molecules was and the arrangements of the molecules in the crystal. This is the kind of speculation that Pasteur was hearing in his lectures at just about this time at the École Normale. Even more important was the influence of the chemist Auguste Laurent. Like Delafosse, he was profoundly influenced by Auy's crystallography, and what he did was extend by analogy Auy's two-part crystal structure model to the explication of organic chemistry taxonomy, and I'll give you an example right now. Taking its point of departure, organic substitution reactions. Think of methane to carbon tet, to take a very simple one. He suggested that families of similar chemical substances all shared a common nuclear radical, like Auy's primitive form in the crystal. Remember that, the cubic with the different faces on it. And modified among the members of a family by substitutions of the hydrogen atoms in the outer layers by molecules of other atoms or atomic groups to form different compounds, but all taxonomically and chemically related to each other. You see how this is building by analogy from Auy's crystal structure theory. Now, the problem faced by Pasteur, another German chemist who was also interested in crystallography, I don't have time to go into his developments, Mitscherlich, announced a discovery in 1844 regarding an isomeric pair. Do you know what isomers are? All of you? Who knows what an isomer is? Undergraduate, then. What's an isomer? Not quite. Two molecules of the same chemical composition that have different properties. And you're quite right, the assumption was already made in the 1820s when the concept emerged that maybe these different properties were due to different arrangements within the chemical molecule of these, you might say, these chemical atoms of the same composition. Now, Mitscherlich found sodium ammonium tartrate and sodium ammonium racemate, same chemical composition. He found no difference in crystal form. this was an example where he could study, so this is related to what you said. He found very little, he found no difference in chemical composition, specific weights, etc., except he found that the tartrates were optically active and the racemates weren't. Now, what in blazes does optically active mean? Well, I happen to have a picture. What it means, I say at the bottom first, is turning the plane of linearly polarized light as it passes through a solution of the organic salt. Now, what in blazes does that mean? Well, nothing like the internet.
Mm-hmm.
This has to do with the wave theory of light, with the notion that as a wave of light moves down this way, in fact, the waves oscillate transversely, perpendicularly to the direction that the light is moving. And here they're going in all different directions. As they pass through this doubly refracting crystal, they became plane polarized. So in this ray, it's just going like this. In this way, it's going like that, perpendicular. Follow that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is my great discovery on the internet. No, this is another, first of all, how you study this, another moment of instrumental technology, the invention of the polarimeter, which enabled scientists to actually study the change in orientation of plane polarized light. And here we go. Good? Here is the plane polarized light, and as it's passing through the solution, notice how it's turning up. That's optical activity. And I thank the internet for providing wonderful things, because it's very difficult to, in words, describe what's going on here. Something like a good animation. Pasteur, here's a big page. What Pasteur found when he studied these is that Mitscherlich was wrong. There was a difference in the crystalline form. That the tartrate crystals had were hemihedral, asymmetrical, as you can see here. They had asymmetrically placed facets. The racemate crystals, when he separated them out, what he found was that, in fact, there were two kinds. One was exactly the same as the sodium ammonium tartrate. The other was the mirror image of them. See that?
Mm-hmm.
When you dissolved equal amounts of both of these in solution, they neutralized each other optically, and you got an optically inactive solution. However, if you dissolved each of these separately, you got one behaved like the tartrates, the other rotated the plane of the polarized light in exactly the opposite direction. Good discovery. He would have gotten a Nobel Prize for that. I'll go through quickly. He gave a lot of credit to both Delafosse for this notion of hemihedry or asymmetry as inspiring him directly, as you can see here. I believe that there might be a relation between the hemihedry of the tartrates and their property of deviating the plane of polarized light, and to Laurent, who was in fact working in his lab at the time and was his kind of mentor. And his first model, I won't even read this, his first speculation was couched in perfect Laurentian terms of a common, you might say, core to the molecule with changes that were done asymmetrically. He eventually abjured Laurent very specifically. And I think he did so, and Jerry Giesen agrees with me, because he was very ambitious and wanted to get on. And Laurent was a bit of an outsider. Anyway. Later on, he defines very intriguingly, suggests what he calls dissymmetry, or disymmetry, molecular disymmetry. Maybe it wrote to these crystals, these asymmetrical crystals, are optically active in solution because their molecules are asymmetrical. Maybe the atoms are placed on in summits of an irregular tetrahedra, or maybe they're on a helix. And maybe that's why we have this asymmetry. Okay, interlude. And we're moving quickly, I think. Separate sequels, chemistry and crystallography, come together magnificently in this French tradition, producing Pasteur's moment of discovery, right?
Mm-hmm.
What happens afterwards? Chemistry develops into stereochemistry, among other things. Crystallography develops in a different direction. My good friend, Evan and I, both of our good friends, Alan Rock, published a book about 20 years ago called The Quiet Revolution, in which he argued that in the 1850s and the 1860s, chemistry went through a kind of quiet revolution, no major break, but involving a number of things. One was the clear fixing of relative atomic weights, which had been contentious up until the time of Cannizzaro in 1859. I don't have time to go into what the contention was about. Take it from me. It was contentious. Second was the emergence of the idea of valence, or bonding. And a third was the further development of structural ideas, originally taking off from the sort of thing Laurent had done, but moving beyond Laurent, and moving away from Laurent's crystallography and crystallographical models. An example I put up here is benzene, Kekulé, and the benzene ring. And that's going to come back at the very end of this talk. But there was one of the other traditions, structural tradition, that builds on all of this, took off from Pasteur's work. And it was the attempt to really get at, you might say, what Delafosse, Laurent, and Pasteur were interested in. Namely, what was the arrangement of atoms in space connected with carbon bonding? It was known that carbon was tetravalent. Well, how could one use this to explain the things that Pasteur discovered? This was finally achieved in 1874 by two men, Vantoff and Lebel. I'm going to focus on Vantoff. Here you can see what he's done. He's really taken Pasteur's idea of a kind of irregular tetrahedral bonding, carbon in the middle with the four valences going up to different atomic groupings. And what he says, to deal with optically active isomers, in the case where the four affinities, four valence, of the carbon atom are saturated with four mutually different univalent groups, two and not more than two different tetrahedra can be formed, which are each other's mirror images. So here was the moment where stereochemistry is born. Very important moment, and critical, and structural stereochemistry develops through the rest of the century. I'm going the wrong way. However, this was done without reference to crystallography, based on Pasteur's work, but it goes to pure organic chemistry for the rest of the century. No reference to crystallography. Meanwhile, crystallography is developing in very different directions, and these continue for the rest of the century. At the beginning of the century, in Germany, a crystallographer by the name of Christian Samuel Weiss turns to symmetry considerations and identifies six of the seven crystal groups. Those of you who have studied crystallography know about this. I'm not going to bother you with them. In the back, you probably can't even see it. Right, so don't worry too much about this slide. But later in the century, back in France, a contemporary of Pasteur, at almost exactly the same time, this time at the École Polytechnique, different school, Pasteur is the École Normale, a physicist, works out the mathematical of crystal symmetry based on the crystal lattice theory. The idea is really kind of like Pauli's molecule integrant, but built up really mathematically rigorously. There are only 14 possible. I promised you a song.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
This is what I found on the web. Here we go. If you have to fill a volume with a structure that's repetitive, just keep your wits about you. You don't need to take a sedative. Don't freeze with indecision. There's no need for you to bust a scene. Although the options may seem endless, really, there are just 14. I think we're getting a moment.
There's cubic, orthorhombic, monoclinic, and tetragonal. There's trigonal, triclinic, and final hexagonal. There's only seven families, but kindly set your mind at ease, cause four had some variety, so there's no improprieties. Did I promise you?
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Here they are. And the next slide, I'm going through very quickly. The mathematical development of crystal structure theory is one major exception, an Englishman named William Barlow. Those doing crystallography will know what I'm talking about. I consulted our crystallographer in the Duke Chemistry Department. She recommended this book, and hence this frame. I found this lovely thing on the web. Rotation, reflection, and inversion will lead you to the 32-point groups. Good illustration. And finally, the 230 space groups identified in the 1890s through translations. Here's a screw axis translation. I barely understand this myself, so I'm not going to try to deal with it. And here are the two major architects of the 230 space groups, Arthur Schoenflies and Yegor Fedorov. In the early 1890s, both mathematicians or mathematical physicists having nothing to do with chemistry. As I suggest, there is one tradition that continues. I go back to the early 19th century. Wollaston, the inventor of the reflective goniometer. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He did that. Wollaston revived that 17th century theory of Hooke and Huygens and the like, that maybe crystals are made not of polyhedra, but of spheres and spheroids. He published in the wake of Dalton's chemical atomic theory, he's thinking of this. He published one major paper in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society of London, and then basically nothing happens to this. I think one other person in America takes it up later in the century, but not much. Until we get to William Barlow, who's an amazing figure. I didn't know much about Barlow before I started working on this talk. He was self-educated, he was wealthy, and so he was able to turn as a kind of hobby to crystallography. And what he does is, among other things, works out independently of Schoenflies and Fedorov the 230 space groups, which I still have only the vaguest idea of what they are. So don't ask me questions about that. But more interestingly, he tries to get back to bringing chemistry and crystallography together through atomic and molecular models. And here's his first paper, which I was able to upload and copy from the web. I wasn't able to get the later paper, so I focused on this, but it'll do. 1883, and this is his kind. He puts himself in the third person. Some studies have led him to believe that in the atomic groupings which modern chemistry reveals to us, the several atoms occupy distinct portions of space and do not lose their individuality. The object of the present paper is to show how far this conclusion is in harmony with, and indeed to some extent explains, the symmetrical forms of crystals. And what he did was use, as I said, in the idea of what's called close packing of atoms. Mathematically, how can you get them close and stable? They're in stable packings. And here's an example he uses. And it might seem, again, as Greg was saying, almost trivial, like common salt or alkali halides. But nobody really knew for sure how they were. And this is Barlow's. This is still speculation. To proceed then to the facts, we know first, as a rule, compounds consisting of an equal number of atoms of two kinds crystallize in cubes. The following may be mentioned. He mentions potassium chloride and potassium bromide here. And here are some of the cubic forms he envisions. Here's an account in the Dictionary of Scientific Biography of Barlow, and I just want to cite this. This cubic guess was correct for the structure of alkali halides and was suggested, and we'll see this, to William Lawrence Bragg,
who in 1913 confirmed it with the first structural determinations by X-ray diffraction. So this, in fact, had this one speculation, unlike Alley, unlike Delafosse, unlike Laurent, this had payoff. This was actually plugged in to the X-ray diffraction endeavor. Okay, here we go. And we're almost done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You with me?
Yes, sir.
Okay? Good. This is the event we're here to celebrate. The April 23rd photographs by von Laue's assistants in Munich, I believe. And their follow-through, perhaps more by the Braggs, father and son, in England. I have to go back. I like this one. This I took actually from one of my own lectures from my 20th century science course. You like that cathode ray too?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that good? Wonderful things on the web. Cathode ray tubes and cathode ray phenomena were one of the great playthings of the late 19th century, the 1880s, the 1890s, and became particularly important in the 1890s. When a number, you may remember the famous or infamous 1894 statement of Albert Michelson in America, that physics had pretty much run its course and that nothing new was to be discovered, only further and further refinement to more and more decimal places. That was the end.
Actually,
well,
he didn't say that.
He say it's quite close, because I actually had to give a lecture on that.
He says somebody else said that.
No, he said it. I found the quote.
Okay.
Because I was asked on our local NPR station. It was a lecture on Marie Curie, and they called me in to give a talk of the context in physics for their work, and I went back and actually looked what he said. He did say something.
Yeah.
I'll try to get you the reference, Greg. Okay. At any rate, whoever said it, it was one of those, at the end of each century, an excursus, at the time when Laplace published his Mécanique Céleste in 1800, they said the same thing, physics is finished. A science writer in 1994, his name is escaping me, said the same about modern science, physics and all. We've gone as far as we can go. And so at the end of each century, somebody says this. Well, cathode rays proved this to be exactly wrong. In 1897, for example, it led J.J. Thomson to interpret what's going on here in terms of electrical discharge as being the emanation of negatively charged particles, which he named
electrons.
How many of you have heard of electrons?
Yay.
Okay. Major change. But you don't get chemistry lectures like this. People singing to you. And 2 years before that, in fact, something even perhaps more startling, in the vicinity of cathode ray emanations, a new ray was detected that seemed to have extraordinarily penetrative properties. This was discovered by Wilhelm Röntgen, what are called Röntgen rays, or more familiarly, X-rays. Röntgen, I might say, was awarded the first Nobel Prize in physics for this discovery. In the first decade or so of the 20th century, actually beyond, it was up for grabs and it was contentious. Were these waves or were they particles? Charles Glover Barkla pretty much seemed to demonstrate that because they exhibited diffraction phenomena, they were transverse waves. On the other hand, William Henry Bragg believed they were particles. But at any rate, for our purposes, what they did lead to was in Munich at the Ludwig Maximilian University. I'll be quick. I see people are beginning to leave. I'll try to finish this quickly. You had an extraordinary group coming together around 1910. Röntgen himself was there as director of the physics laboratory. Arnold Sommerfeld, very important physicist of the first quarter of the 20th century, had been brought
as the director of the Institute for Theoretical Physics. What most people don't realize, theoretical physics was a new field in the early 20th century. Experimental physics had been the main thing. There was a very eminent mineralogist and crystallographer by the name of Paul von Groff, who was very much into crystal lattice theory and even himself to try to do the kind of thing Barlow had been trying to do, to explicate these in terms of atomic arrangement. There was a student of Sommerfeld's who was working on propagation of all kinds of electromagnetic radiations in crystals, named Peter Paul Ewald. And finally, there was Max von Laue, who had been brought to Munich by Sommerfeld as a Privatdozent. Laue, as I say, joins Sommerfeld's group in 1909, was immediately struck by, this is from, again, an article on this group, by the atmosphere that was saturated with questions of the nature of X-rays. Many people at Munich were concerned with X-rays and with crystal lattice structure. And moreover, they met weekly, only the way science should be done, the way everything should be done, at a cafe, right? For cake, coffee, schnapps, who knows what else, and to discuss things. I would suggest, having read reviews recently of this book by John Gerther, The Idea Factory, Bell Labs and the Great Age of American Innovation, which makes the claim that Bell Labs succeeded so mightily because interdisciplinarity, a horrible word, was fostered. I would suggest something similar is going on here, in a much more informal but very, very productive way. This is the famous story. In February 1912, Ewald came to, after their meeting in the cafe, to von Laue and said he had real problems trying to explain the behavior of long-waved electromagnetic radiation in crystals. Von Laue didn't know the answer, but it gave him an idea. Since he had been working with X-rays and crystals, hey, maybe X-rays, which were a very short wavelength, that's why they were so powerful, maybe they could be used to get at the nature of atomic arrangement in crystals, because maybe the wavelength was of the magnitude of the separation of layers of atoms. And so the atoms could serve as a diffraction grating, producing what's called interference patterns. This was taken up. Sommerfeld gave permission to assistants set up the setup down there for taking these pictures. Greg mentioned this earlier. There's one of the earliest pictures that was done. One of the first, it's not very good, but it's one of the first successful pictures that was done. Here is the setup. I'm not going to go through it. Here's the zinc blood, the zinc sulfide X-ray diffraction. I'll leave this PowerPoint for anybody who wants to study it. Now, this will move quickly to England. The Braggs, father and son, William Henry Bragg, was a physicist, mathematician, who spent much of his career in Australia. But he got interested in X-rays and radioactivity, published important papers, was brought back to Leeds University in 1909. His son was a real wunderkind, child prodigy, William Lawrence Bragg, and he immediately went to Trinity College, Cambridge. 1912, June, a letter from somebody in Munich who's working with von Laue, the name Lars Vegar, is sent to William Henry Bragg, saying the following: regarding the explanation, Laue thinks it's due to the diffraction of the Röntgen rays by the regular structure of the crystal. He is, however, at present unable to explain the phenomenon in its detail. Once back in Cambridge, Willie, this is William Lawrence Bragg, the son, continued to pore over the Laue results and recalled the crystal structure theories of William Pope and William Barlow. They had worked together. He became convinced that the effect was optical and visualized an explanation in terms of the simple reflection of X-rays from the planes of atoms within the crystal.
He therefore devised Bragg's law, which is at the bottom there and which is here. Again, I won't go through it. This I do understand, but there's no time to go through this one. You'll be able to study it at your leisure. There'll be a quiz tomorrow.
He was 21, I think.
That's right.
Yeah, he was 21.
Here they are. Father, rather Colonel Blimpish looking. Son, in this picture, very dashing looking. If you read Watson's Double Helix, he's become a kind of Colonel Blimp. By the time Watson gets there in the 1950s. Here he's quite dashing looking. The youngest Nobel laureate, I think, still in the history of the Nobel Prize. They both got their Nobel Prize. And here is their great book, which, as I was telling Vera, is completely uploadable on Google Books. You can get X-rays and crystal structure published in 1915 and pull it up, as I did. Here is what they did. It is natural to suppose that the Lowy patterns owes its origin to the interference of waves diffracted in a number of centers which are closely connected with the atoms or molecules of which the crystal is built and are therefore arranged according to the same plan. The crystal is in fact acting as a diffraction grating. Here are the zinc blend or zinc sulfide photographs, again, taken in Munich. And here is their explanation, again, in their book. The most satisfying result, there's the picture from the book, was on von Laue's photograph of diffraction from zinc blended crystals. Von Laue had assumed the atoms in zinc blend are arranged in a simple cubic lattice. But if this was true, Bragg's law wouldn't explain the diffraction pattern. But if the arrangement was arranged in, and this is one of Bravais's 14 of forms, was arranged in a face-centered cubic lattice, the diffraction pattern was explained perfectly. Here's a picture. I am at the end, late 1920s. We've come full circle with Kathleen Lonsdale, a study of benzene by X-ray diffraction. And I think this is wonderful. I pulled this up. I couldn't have said it better. She was clearly thinking of my talk when she wrote this. A number of important deductions can be made even from this approximate result. One, the molecule exists in the crystal as a separate entity. Two, the benzene carbon atoms are arranged in a ring formation. Three, the ring is hexagonal or pseudo-hexagonal in shape. These facts have been believed by chemists for a long time, and nearly all the models which have been suggested have conformed to these rules. But so far, no aromatic substance, that's a benzene, except the one under investigation, which is down at the bottom there, have had a simple enough structure for positions of the separate atoms to be found without any previous hypothesis as to the shape or size of the molecule. The above reasoning, in fact, supplies a definite proof from an X-ray point of view that the chemist's conception of the benzene ring is a true representation of the facts. The end.
I am told we're going to take time for just maybe two or three questions.
Okay. Don't ask me about 230 space articles. I don't know anything.
Yes.
So, not a chemist, but a librarian, and you raised a really interesting question right at the beginning of your talk in a very offhanded way. But you showed some slides and some wonderful photographs that are crucial for understanding how it is that light moves through these structures and allows us to understand how they work. What kind of advice would you give to librarians who are trying to build collections that document the history of science?
Oh, very interesting question. Wow, that's a nice question. I can wrap my mind around that one. It's tricky. I developed a course in 20th century science. And it is very difficult to convey, let's say, ideas in special relativity, such as time dilation and the like, without using interactive and even animated examples. And there are lots of wonderful ones on the web. There's a spectacular one, I might say, for Einstein's photoelectric effect paper.
which is where Einstein proved, you might say, the particulate wave nature of light, photons, by showing that electrical current was not proportional to the intensity of the light, but inversely proportional to the wavelength. And he was immediately put that into Planck's law, which Planck enunciated as a kind of abstract hypothesis in 1900. Einstein in 1905 bodies this out in a particular phenomenon. It's wonderful if you can display some of these things with pictures and even with animation. I have no way, I don't know how I would explain optical activity without that animation. Showing plain polarized light being deviated. And I think this is true in science museums. I might say I'm on the National Historic Chemical Landmarks Committee. There's about one. In fact, we're having a meeting tomorrow that I'm going to go to because I'm back. I approached, we give plaques for major landmarks in science. I approached our local science museum about displaying these plaques, and they said no. Because science museums have become animated and interactive. And these plaques have too much information. Science museums have moved away from, and so I don't know if librarians face this too. We try to put something that people won't just walk by and say, yes, very nice, very nice, and then walk out.
I'd maybe add that maybe an important consideration, which I'm sure you're aware of, is the purpose of the collection, whether
yeah,
it's for scholarly research or whether it's for public outreach or some
other function. Yeah, very good question. Very good
and
point.
That'll dictate somewhat different criteria.
Do you want to become something like a science museum when you display these, or is it for scholarly purpose?
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes, Greg answered better than I did. Other questions?
Some of the first crystals that they analyzed? You mentioned zinc sulfide.
Well, yeah, zinc sulfide in some ways was the most important.
So what are the others?
Well, some of the alkali halides, for example, they also analyzed. The first one they used, von Mauer used, or Friedrich and Gipping, was copper sulfate. And that didn't work so well. It turned out to be a little, initially, too complicated. These very simple, you might say, binary compounds proved initially the easiest ones. I'm not sure. This is a work in progress. I've just been learning.
I can add a few things. I teach the course. Yeah, sodium chloride, cesium chloride, zinc sulfide, diamond crystals.
Yeah,
some of the first. And the reasons were that the atomic positions were precisely determined from just the pattern itself. You knew exactly where the atoms were. In 1913, Bragg developed a way to determine from the intensities how to determine where the atoms were, where they weren't precisely timed, determined just by the spatial diffraction pattern.
That's, so, I might say, what he did with the zinc sulfide.
Zinc sulfide he did before that.
But it's also used.
It iron sulfide, actually, pyrite and calcium carbonate were the first two.
Oh, I see. Okay, because
that's right. Early on, that's right. So, but all inorganic substances. The first organic substance, well, diamond, I count as inorganic. Lonsdale did work on various diamond polymorphs later
benzene,
on,
yeah.
And then benzene as well. That's right. Or hexamethyl benzene.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does anything happen in
crystallography
now?
Don't ask me.
I'm working on Alfred Nobel.
The newest thing is higher dimensional modulated crystal structures, so things that are not supported on the simple lattice type.
Last year's Nobel Prize actually was for a class of substances that are called quasi-crystals, which break all the laws that OE and Bravais developed. They are, most crystals end up being what are called periodic or repeating versions of the same basic motif, but that there are crystals which are called aperiodic, and there's actually, they talk about eight dimensions in order to try to understand the structures of those, and there are lots of other technical elements.
Now, are they the things, in this wonderfully suggested book by Erwin Schrödinger, What is Life? He talks about aperiodic and periodic crystals.
As a basis,
plays
as a basis of life.
In very interesting ways with them. And, of course, that book had tremendous impact on the early people, including Watson and Crick.
Right, because he talks about how life is an organized process, but it's not organized in a periodic
way. Right. That's right. And absolutely fascinating.
Just relates to tiling structures.
Exactly, right. And it turns out these quasicrystals are not tiling patterns. That's right. So I think I'll end things now. You can certainly ask Cy other questions over receipts. But
I can teach you the song, the Brave Lady.